tell you what, we're surrounded by boxes. I don't know why I said it like Hank Hill. I'll tell you what. That's a terrible. He didn't sound anything like that. Hey everyone, I'm Patrick Jones, and welcome to episode 28 of That Gives Me Anxiety. Yeah, talking about boxes because Jamie and I bought a house. Very exciting stuff. Of course, a very stressful situation, if you've seen anything or interacted with the housing market over the last couple of years. But it's done, it's over with. Now all we have to do is pack up everything. I mean, we're staying in Charleston, so the move will be significantly easier than moving from Brooklyn to Charleston, which I think took years off my life. And now we're moving less than a mile. I could jog the couch down there. I won't, but I could. Just nice that a move can be contained to one day. Having to drive a moving truck and I stopped in Maryland at a hotel when I got too tired because it was just this crazy mess when we moved down to Charleston. And just having basically everything you own in a truck in a parking lot of a roadside hotel. You're not really going to sleep that well. But yeah, for first home purchase. And I definitely should do an episode on that. On buying a house. But it's so much anxiety. Well, I've got a great interview lined up. It's the full interview on social anxiety with Dr. Fallon Goodman. But I wanted to release the full interview because so about half of the interview didn't make it into that episode. And there was a lot of good stuff in the interview, including aspects of how alcohol can come into play. You know, when you're feeling socially anxious, you may have a few extra drinks. And then you may think that that's the only way that you can interact socially, and that leads to problems of its own. So yeah, I thought that was a really important aspect that I wanted the full interview to get out there, and I think it'll be really helpful. Before we get to that interview, I want to remind you to, if you're liking the show, please remember to rate and review it in whatever platform you're listening on. You can check the show out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, or YouTube. I don't know what social media platforms you like. If you like them all, check them out on all. Also, if you're liking the show and you want to support it and support me, there's the Buy Me a Coffee link. If you're unfamiliar, Buy Me a Coffee is just a way to make a donation that would help me keep making these. And that would be very much appreciated. Well, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Fallon, and enjoy the interview. Joining me now on the podcast is Dr. Fallon Goodman, who's a professor of psychology at the University of South Florida. Fallon, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Pat. I appreciate it.
Yeah, super excited today to talk to you about social anxiety. I think it's something that, of course, so many people struggle with, and I haven't seen too much out there in terms of answers, so I'm excited to pick your brain a bit.
This has been my fight recently, talking about social anxiety. It's one of the, I call it the bastard child of anxiety disorders, because despite how popular it is, it's hardly talked about, and we know very little about social anxiety.
Well, why don't we start with giving us a little bit of your background?
Yeah, so I'm an assistant professor at the University of South Florida, and my entire lab's mission is to understand how people connect with others and build happy, meaningful lives, which on its surface sounds like a simple mission, but understanding how and why people connect with others is really more complicated, primarily because there are a lot of things that get in the way of people connecting. Mm-hmm. And so really the origin story of all of this is I come from a large Italian family in New Jersey. You know, everyone's got 3+ kids, every Sunday, Sunday fun day, Sunday gravy, weddings, graduations. We're never not around other people. And so I was surrounded by amazing opportunities for social relationships and pretty much filled with social activities. And yet there were bouts of loneliness and disconnection. I remember being at my cousin's wedding and sitting at the side, watching everyone dancing, enjoying each other's company, laughing. And I really didn't understand why I was having so much trouble connecting when I had every opportunity to connect. I played soccer growing up, lots of teammates. And so when I got to the University of Maryland, I started understanding that unfortunately humans have several things that get in the way and you can be lonely in a crowd. And so I started researching social anxiety and realized that children as young as 5 can feel socially anxious. And social anxiety is one of the biggest barriers to social connection. So in order to really understand why people or and how people connect with others, you really have to understand the barriers. And social anxiety over and over was coming up. I studied it in young children. I studied it in teenagers, and then eventually in grad school in adults. And across the board, over and over, social anxiety was one of the big challenges to connecting with other people.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you and I have very similar experiences growing up. I'm from a giant Irish family, parents full of like my dad's one of like 15. So instead of Sunday gravy, it's just like Sunday, like lumpy potatoes. But other than that, but yes, I do know exactly what you're talking about, where constantly surrounded by people, but growing up, but I also have experienced that, like where I feel like I'm not connecting and I'm not sure why. And so, yeah, it is interesting where it was like, I felt that way my whole time growing up, but then people would say, you have such an easy time making friends. And it felt like there was a huge disconnect with how I felt versus how I was perceived, which is very interesting and something that I have to continue to work on.
And here's the thing. You could have a lot of friends and be lonely. You can have a lot of friends and have social anxiety. You can have a romantic partner. You can be in a career where you're public facing, maybe you're performing like an athlete, or you're giving lots of speeches and talks, and still have social anxiety. Social anxiety is not a badge of honor or shame that people walk around with where you can visibly see it. It's something a lot of times people are struggling with silently.
Right. Well, where is, it's good to get I guess, a definition of where is just like an awkward moment and or social anxiety. Where does that line cross over?
So at its core, social anxiety is about the fear of being rejected. And that can look like a lot of different things. I think the first thing to clarify is that almost all humans feel social anxiety. In some ways, it can be considered an emotional experience where in the moment, you're worrying about what other people are thinking about you, worrying about making a bad impression, making a fool of yourself, having that awkward moment, that awkward pause. And you're worrying that if any of those things happen, then you will be rejected. Mm-hmm. Rejected could mean an overt objection, like I never want to date you, thank you very much, bye-bye. Or it could be something more subtle where you don't really realize the rejection occurred. You just maybe don't go on to develop a meaningful relationship with that person. So most people feel socially anxious at many points in their life, maybe at many points during their day. But social anxiety becomes problematic when it begins interfering with a person's life. And that happens when that fear of rejection blossoms into this really picture of oneself, meaning that a person believes that they have some set of flaws or inferiorities. And if other people see those flaws, they notice them, then they're going to be rejected as a result of those flaws. So someone's social anxiety disorder, when it becomes clinical, has significant anxiety and concern that when they interact with other people will see that flaw. Maybe they think they're not smart enough. Maybe they think they're not attractive enough. Maybe they think they're not funny enough or lovable enough, insert whatever enough. And when they have a social interaction, they worry that other people are going to see that flaw and reject them as a result. So what ends up happening is they start to avoid social interactions, or during social interactions, they default to various safety behaviors, things that they can do subtly to try and conceal those perceived flaws and limit the opportunity for rejection. Maybe they're avoiding eye contact. Maybe they're not asking questions that they're actually really curious about. Maybe they're not sharing about themselves. Maybe they're restricting the emotions that they're conveying because they don't want to seem too happy or too sad or too silly or do something awkward. And so what ends up happening is the person with social anxiety disorder becomes so focused on themselves, not in a selfish way, but because they are so insistent on monitoring their behaviors out of fear of rejection. And during that interaction, because they become so self-focused, have a difficult time connecting with other people because they're not fully present in the moment. So really, the sad thing is that someone's fear of rejection really gets in the way of obtaining and appreciating the benefits of being accepted. because the fear of rejection turns someone inward, where they're monitoring their thoughts and behaviors, worrying about rejection, wanting to be accepted. But as a result of that, they're missing out on what's happening around them. They're missing out on the conversation. They're missing out on the nuances of social interactions that ultimately lead to intimate, lasting relationships.
And that feels a little bit like it can snowball, like, and just get worse and worse and worse if you are starved for interaction or meaningful connection. You feeling like you're not getting it could make it worse.
And you know this, Pat, all the people you've interviewed, is that when people are anxious, they avoid.
Yeah.
This is how human, and the thing is it's effective. If you have a phobia of bridges and you don't go on a bridge, or you quickly leave upon entering a bridge, then you feel less anxious. It is super effective in the short term. The problem is, in the long term, your anxiety gets worse, likely to get worse. And that anxiety begins to spread into other areas and really start to become impairing. So the dirty secret about social anxiety that I don't always talk about, because it's hard to really explain, is that a person's fear is about rejection. So the core fear of social anxiety is rejection. But the more someone avoids social interactions, the more likely they are to be rejected. And this is because they're having fewer opportunities to socialize, to practice. Humans need practice. And when we interact with other people, we learn how social dynamics work. We learn about other people. We learn what's awkward, what's not awkward, what's effective, what's not. And as a result of some of those safety behaviors I was just mentioning, the person with social anxiety is engaging in some undesirable social behaviors. So, like, what makes a social interaction good? When people ask you questions about, everyone likes to talk about themselves. When people ask questions, when you're making eye contact, that'll help build intimacy. When you're being authentic and funny and loose, all of those things breed good interactions. But if you have social anxiety, you're going to have trouble doing most of them. And so those awkward moments that they fear are more likely to happen. And so this is a really difficult, when we talk about treatment, which we'll talk about later, this is a really difficult conundrum that people need to face, is that their worst fear of rejection might be more likely to be true as a result of their social anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what we talk about in treatment is working on social skills, working on how to have good social interactions, and helping the person see that their social anxiety is causing them to engage in some behaviors that might actually make it more likely for rejection to occur.
Interesting. So you described a few ways that social anxiety shows up, and most of it kind of falls into a bin of muting maybe your personality or your personal feelings at a time. Is that the same for someone that, let's say, drinks too much or goes the other way and is loud? Or is that something different, you think?
So the prototypical person with social anxiety tends to be avoidant, tends to be withdrawn, and will, like you say, sort of default to these avoidance behaviors. But we also know from epidemiological research that there is a subgroup of people with social anxiety that do the opposite. So they manage their anxiety with approach-oriented behaviors, meaning that they're approaching their anxiety with things like substance use, aggression, impulsivity, risky sexual behavior. The way to sort of describe it is you want to reject the rejector before they reject you. So if you're getting ahead of it, maybe you're trying to dominate the conversation. Maybe you don't stop talking because if you keep talking, the other person doesn't have an opportunity to say something that's going to be perceived as rejection. And so in particular, alcohol use is a real big problem. Mm-hmm. Social anxiety disorder is highly comorbid with alcohol use disorder. And what we know is that social anxiety disorder comes first. It develops first most of the time, about 80% of the time, meaning that social anxiety puts people at risk for developing problems with alcohol use. And we can see why. We especially in the United States, we live in a culture that glorifies drinking and glorifies social drinking in particular. I mean, watch a football game and wait for the commercials and you have hot women and these fun looking parties and everyone's doing God knows what. And so a person with social anxiety might see, or really anyone might see, alcohol as a way to facilitate good interactions, because it does. We know that it does. But if that becomes something that you're relying on to socially connect, then that's where you start to get into dangerous territory, that you feel like you need alcohol to connect with other people in social settings. And so people with social anxiety disorder tend to have some difficulties with things like alcohol use as a way to obtain the social interactions that they feel like they don't have.
Yeah, to be open and honest, that's something that I definitely struggled with at points in my life, and for the exact reasons that you're describing, where you're so afraid to meet new people, you remove 20% of your inhibitions with beers or whatever, it makes it easier, but it always led to the feeling being worse, and I only share that as a way to be open and honest, and I want this to be a space that things like that could be shared. Yeah, that was a big turning point in my life to realize that that was not what I wanted, and not to get to where I wanted to be in terms of social interaction.
I've been there too, Pat. And, you know, I started at University of Maryland not knowing anyone. And I quickly joined a sorority, something I never thought I'd do, by the way. And I didn't know how to connect with people. I don't think I ever really learned properly. I always had these built-in structures through things like soccer, these built-in teammates through, you know, classes, you have built-in friends. And then you get to the big bad world of college, for example, and you don't have those structures. I mean, maybe you have your dorms, but there are fewer structures. And so alcohol, and people use the term liquid courage.
Yeah.
Alcohol makes it easier for you to talk to people. It makes it easier for you to, you know, ask questions and connect. And so it is helpful in the short term. Again, a lot of anxiety is really about understanding what's helpful in the short term and then what's helpful in the long term. So does drinking those few beers help you connect with other people in the short term? Maybe. But is that becoming a pattern that's interfering with your long-term health, whether it's your physical health or your ability to connect with other people in situations where you're sober?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned anxiety spreading. Very interesting idea. It feels like, you know, I have another podcast and it's about grief, and a lot of psychologists that come on and talk about how grief, if you don't acknowledge it and deal with it, it can spread to other behaviors. Can you talk a little bit about how anxiety kind of can sit inside the body and mind and sort of interrupt other parts of your life or make you more anxious elsewhere?
Yeah, so I think the best analogy is you have a glass of water, or water, or where I'm from, that's we say water. Yeah. You have a glass of water and you put a drop of ink in it, and it eventually spreads to consume the whole glass. And anxiety operates in a similar way if you're avoiding it. So a good example is to take a phobia. So I once had a patient who had a phobia of butterflies, which is quite an interesting phobia. The treatment, by the way, I had to order a butterfly larva, grow them, kill a couple of them for the exposures, because you had to gradually build up from dead to live ones. And then we had exposure with butterflies.
Oh, wow.
So her phobia started with a very specific creature. And she, whenever she would encounter a butterfly, she would feel panic. She would start sweating, shaking, try to run away, leave the situation. Butterflies are most common in the spring. So she felt okay in other seasons. And so her anxiety started just in the spring. But then the more she, this young girl encountered butterflies in different situations, the more fearful she became of those situations. So the origin of the butterfly phobia was at a butterfly conservatory, something very specific where they're contained. But butterflies exist in our world. And so the next situation was a butterfly in like a park area. Mm-hmm. And so then she associated the park with fear because she felt fearful and panicked. She had an anxiety response in the park. So what happens is she starts avoiding the parks. Well, you know, a few weeks later, then she sees a butterfly somewhere around her school. And so now she's worrying that her school, there are butterflies around her school, and now she's not wanting to go to school. So something so specific, because of largely because of avoidance, you start to build this fear that you're worrying you're going to encounter the feared thing everywhere.
Oh, now, wow.
It could go the opposite. Another way that anxiety could spread is it can generalize. So I've never shared this story, so I'm going to share it today. I had a really, really bad car accident, terrible car accident, totaled my car. I was driving home, two of my friends, you know, luckily no one was hurt, but essentially a piece of my engine literally ripped out of the car on the highway. And it just so happened to do that right before I was driving on a bridge. So I was about to, we were going home for Thanksgiving break, and I was just about to start driving over this bridge. I didn't realize until a few weeks later that I started developing anxiety about bridges. And I thought maybe it was heights. Anxiety is a lot about modeling, and my mother doesn't really love bridges. But then that fear of bridges really turned into anxiety about driving, because every time I was driving, I was worried that I would have to cross a bridge. And then the fear generalize even further to just generally fear of heights, because a bridge is going to be high. And then so I found myself two stories up on a building feeling anxious, or walking over an overpass feeling anxious. And I realized that this one incident, this traumatic incident of anxiety, created this phobia of bridges. And then that the source of that fear, which was bridges, generalized to things like driving, where I could encounter a bridge, but then also to generally fear of heights. And so the spreading of anxiety can occur in a few different ways. I think the key mechanism, though, is avoidance, because the more you're avoiding something, the more power you're giving it, the more your brain is perceiving it as scary. And so you create this anxiety, and you don't get practice encountering it. So the anxiety builds and builds and builds.
Wow. Thank you for sharing that story. I'm sorry that that sounds pretty scary.
So let me get this straight. In today's day and age, you're supposed to be drinking a ton of water, doing yoga, making sure you and your whole family is happy, strike a good work-life balance, exercise, read books, watch movies, eat healthy meals, be a big part of your community, and get 8 hours of sleep. It's unrealistic. It's too much. Well, that's why there's Instacart to take a little bit off your plate, or help put a little bit on your plate. Oh, I'm so sorry. Using Instacart, you search for all your favorite foods and items that you need from the grocery store, fresh produce, all your favorites, everything you want, and they deliver it to you. They go to the store and do your shopping for you. Just remove it from your to-do list, just with a few clicks. And you'll have your items delivered to your door in as fast as an hour. It's pretty quick. And through the link in the episode description, they're offering free delivery on your first order over $35. But you gotta make sure you click the link in the description. That tells Instacart that this show sent you, and it helps support the show. And you can also take advantage of the free delivery. So yeah, be nice to yourself. Give Instacart a shot.
I guess as a... The first thing that comes to mind is I spent, my fiance and I spent most of, or the first year of the pandemic in Brooklyn, New York, and extremely anxiety inducing with all the people with COVID passing away and all that. And my anxiety began with fear of the virus, and then started to go, people were fighting in grocery stores. And so I became super anxious anytime I had to like leave our apartment, because I was just having negative experience after negative experience until it pretty much touched almost everything I was doing. And so it seems similar to that, in that it just kind of taints everything that you're trying to get done.
Anxiety is not well contained. We don't have buckets of anxiety in our life that we can keep in a nice neat package. It'd be great if we did, because then we could effectively avoid them. But unfortunately, that's not how anxiety works.
Yeah, that's a shame. Yeah, so let's talk about treating social anxiety. Is there, I'm assuming there isn't a one size fits all, but how do you start by approaching it?
There's definitely not a one size fits all, but if there's anything psychologists have learned in the past 50 plus years, it's that exposure treats anxiety. And so there's a few caveats to exposure, or a few considerations. The first is, exposure can actually reinforce. Let me step back. What I mean by exposure is encountering the thing that scares you. And typically we do this systematically. So you might build what we call a fear hierarchy, where at the very top, you have your most feared situation. In this case, we would want to restrict it to social situations just to make the exposure more tractable. So you'd have your most feared social situation as specific as possible. Maybe it's giving a talk to 100 people in an auditorium, or maybe it's going on a first date in a certain location or a certain time of your life. And then you work your way down on your hierarchy and you list situations that are increasingly less anxiety provoking. And so what you'd want to do is start with the least anxiety provoking situation on your hierarchy and do it. Here's the key though, and this is what people get wrong a lot of the time. You don't want to just do it and white knuckle through it. Because what you would do if you white knuckle, so let's use my driving anxiety, which I still have, by the way. If I want to drive over a bridge and I pick any bridge and I know that I can get off the exit right after the bridge and I can get on the exit right before the bridge, and I pretty much floor it and close my eyes and squeeze my steering wheel and blast some good rap music and I'm off. Whew, okay, I did that exposure.
Mm-hmm.
But all I've done is do a brilliant job of reinforcing my anxiety because I was anxious the entire time. And my anxiety only subsided when I was no longer on the bridge. I was no longer in the situation.
Yeah.
So good job. I've just made it worse. So the key with any exposure is to stay in the situation long enough for your anxiety to reduce. We say about 50%. It's hard to quantify, but you want to get to a place where your anxiety is noticeably decreased. So people ask, well, how long should I do exposure? And the answer is always as long as it takes for your anxiety to go down.
Hmm.
Maybe it's 2 minutes, maybe it's 2 hours. Eventually though, your body will become exhausted and you will become acclimated to the situation and your anxiety will begin to go down. So for something like social anxiety, identifying specific social situations for you, everyone's social anxiety looks a little bit different, and then doing them over and over again until you feel like your anxiety is manageable. The other key here is we're not looking for ground zero of anxiety. People will feel anxious. Unfortunately, a part about being human is that we have anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And so to aim for zero is really, it's not necessary and it's probably not likely. Rather, it's getting to a place of anxiety that feels manageable and allows you to engage in the situation in a way that's consistent with how you want to live your life, whether that's speaking up in class or, you know, giving a really good talk if that's important to you. And so you go through that systematically and ultimately, you know, the goal is to get to the tip top of that hierarchy and be in that situation where you can really engage the way you want to engage.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very important. That is interesting about exposure therapy, where I definitely am very anxious on planes and it's awful at takeoff. It's so bad. But then usually by the end, or once we're in the air for a while, like I've calmed down, right? I'm just like sitting there watching a movie. It's fine. But it's white knuckle every time. And so that is good for me to hear the aspect of taking stock of the time where your body did get exhausted and relax. So the problem for me and how I want to relate that back to social anxiety is I tend to remember the initial, the takeoff and how anxious I was then versus the hours where I was fine. So I assume people who are really socially anxious have something similar going on. Is there any advice that you would give to someone in that situation?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the human brain is we're really designed to process things as they come, not so much remember, but remembering is intended to help us, help protect our, to learn, of course, but also to protect ourselves. So we tend to remember really bad things with the hopes that the next time that bad thing happens, then we could act differently in a way that we're not going to be so hurt. So with social anxiety, oftentimes we'll hear about bullying or really adverse social experiences. Maybe you were made fun of in some way, or, you know, you had some really brutal rejection after a first date. We've all been there. And so that's what you remember that. And the same, by the way, with trauma, right? You will remember that those flashbulb moments where that really bad thing occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, going into exposure, I think you want to be careful about thinking about past experiences, because if you're relying on your memory is probably going to be of pretty crappy past social experiences. And what people with social anxiety disorder tend to do is they use it as evidence for why they will be rejected in the upcoming situation. And so there's an overestimation of rejection. Well, this bad thing happened, you know, 2 years ago in a similar situation, so this is likely to happen again. So be really careful about which memories you're drawing from. But I would say, regardless of what happened, we can't prevent rejection. Like, at some point in our lives, we will be rejected. At some point this year, you're going to be rejected. Sorry, but that's another crappy part about being human. The goal of treating social anxiety isn't to prevent rejection. It's to encourage social courage. It's to foster social courage in a way that gets people engaging in interactions that are consistent with their values and the life they want to live. And so relying on your estimation of how likely it is to be successful is really, it's always going to be faulty. You're going to turn back and think about the prior bad social experiences, or maybe let's go the opposite way. If you think about when you crushed that prior social experience and then, you know, your next one goes awry, you know, is that evidence that you're a failure? No, it's just evidence that you had a crappy social interaction. And maybe it is your fault. Maybe you did something weird, or maybe it's the situation, or maybe it's interaction, or all of the above. And so memory gets a little bit tricky in terms of exposure. I think the key here is, prior to doing any of this, identifying what it is that's important to you.
Mm.
Do you want to develop good relationships with your coworkers? Do you want to develop a romantic relationship? Do you want to advance in your career? And that's going, and those things are going to require you addressing your social anxiety. And so really the interventions or the exposures should be guided by your goals and values.
Yeah. I always think too, in terms of social rejection, that you do always end up with a funny story, right? The time that you flubbed saying something in class, or you were rejected for something you did on a date, to people who are near and dear, it's kind of a fun story to share, you know, and it kind of is a badge of honor of being human to make a mistake in that regard.
I mean, I've yet to meet anyone who hasn't been rejected in some way.
Yeah.
Whether it's peers or things like jobs, whether it's romantic relationships. Humans are not only social, but we're cliquey. We exist in our tribes, and we protect our tribes and are fearful and therefore skeptical of out-group members. And so, you know, the likelihood of rejection is just, it's almost 100%.
Yeah.
And just to say, though, those rejections can be brutally painful. Mm-hmm. Like, let's be clear here that rejection is painful. It's incredibly painful. Being rejected and feeling lonely as a result can lead to, for a long period of time, can lead to different health effects. And so it's really problematic. But the goal of addressing social anxiety isn't about preventing it. It's about getting better at managing it when it does occur.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good context.
Look who we got here. It's our friends at My Software Tutor. Can Excel be my friend? Many people have wondered this for years. The answer is yes, it can. Excel doesn't have to be like the friend that your mom makes you hang out with in elementary school. It's weird. It's always stuff with boogers. Right? What's wrong? What's up? Why is that kid always eating boogers? Their house always had the best snacks, too. And there he is. Boogers. Well, Excel doesn't have to be like that weird kid. Unless you were that weird kid. Were you? Be honest. You know. I'm not actually asking. I can't hear your response, but you know. And it's okay if you were. You know, just take it easy with the boogers. Just talking about boogers to Oregon ad read. Don't worry. They didn't write that part. That was an improvisation. My Software Tutor offers 3 levels of real-time Zoom-based courses with a live instructor. They deliver practical, functional business skills in a friendly and supportive environment. It can be daunting, right? You need that supporting environment to learn Excel. There's no stupid questions. It could be really difficult. And as we know, and we talk about it on this podcast all the time, it could be really daunting to learn something new and put yourself out there. So think of this as like a kindergarten for
learning something new and helping your job prospects. Or be better at the job you already have. Get that raise. Get that whatever. Take pictures of it for Instagram. Yeah, that'll be cool. Keeping it as vague as possible so that you can input your own. Just making a mad lib of your own desires. These courses will increase your marketability, whether you're an employee, job seeker, consultant, or contractor. Register at mysoftwaretutor.com and use the promo code POD20 to save 20% off all registrations. Thank you so much to My Software Tutor. Yeah, guys, take advantage of that 20% off and confidently list Excel on your resume.
I'm curious about, you mentioned different social techniques that you work on with people who have social anxiety. I'm curious what some of those are in terms of how you're treating people.
Sure. So the exposure should, if you're doing exposure work, either with the assistance of a therapist or on your own with the assistance of someone in your life, the key is to make it as specific as possible based on your, you know, flavor of social anxiety. And then once you identify situations that are fearful, you want to diversify them. So I once had a patient who had social anxiety, and her big source of her fear was speaking on the phone, which I think, by the way, the more and more we're texting and emailing, this is probably going to increase.
Yeah.
So I decided to draw from my New Jersey roots and have her call a pizzeria in New Jersey, which, you know, they don't, you know, they're not the most patient humans in the world. And so I called one that I knew wouldn't be so courteous or patient. And so she called them, and her task, and I should say all of this is developed with the patient or the person prior to the, you don't just dump this on them. They agree and they consent and they help build it. Mm-hmm. And so her job was to order a everything pizza and take one ingredient off of the pizza one by one. So she called, and my boy Joey says, "Hey, how you doing? What do you want?" And she says, "I'd like to order an everything pizza." He says, "Great, $17.99, be ready in 20 minutes. She's like, "Oh, sorry, I just want to take off the mushrooms." "Oh, okay, whatever. Everything pizza, no mushrooms. Got it. $17.99, 20 minutes. And I would also just like to take off the onions as well."
Oh my gosh.
And he's getting more and more mad. And finally, he flips out and says, "You know what, lady? Why don't you just order a plain pie? I don't have time for this." Boom, click. So in this moment, this person has social anxiety disorder, specifically about the phone. That's one of her most feared situations. And she just got like pretty brutally rejected. This guy
yells at
her. He's upset, right? And it was the perfect exposure because she realized, first of all, obviously she's being outlandish. The likelihood that this would happen in real life is low. Like she's in some ways causing this rejection. But guess what? She got rejected and it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
She learned how to handle this rejection. It's a really specific form of rejection that's unlikely to occur, but she learned that it's okay and that she's still there and she's good. And she had developed all of these coping skills. So, you know, one key with thinking about your own different social exposures is figuring out, you know, what's most scary to you, but then being creative and diversifying how you're doing those exposures and expecting that rejection will occur. I set her up to fail in terms of social rejection, which is a perfect exposure to do because then she gets practice handling rejection.
That's so funny. You've mentioned a few times that you've had to come up, be really creative with the exposure, which is kind of fun, it seems.
it definitely can be. I think being an exposure therapist, you know, I don't do clinical work anymore, but when I did, I worked with OCD and social anxiety disorder and phobias and agoraphobia. You have to be creative because, like we were talking about with anxiety spreading, if you're only doing exposures about a very specific situation, the person's going to say check mark, but then this other really specific situation will still be anxiety provoking. So you need mm-hmm. to hit all of the facets of anxiety. But the other thing in terms of some social skills training is if a person has social anxiety disorder, they're more likely to have some social skills deficits or some difficulties engaging in desirable social behaviors, in part because they haven't had as much practice. We don't see this all the time, but these are especially problematic because they're more likely to elicit rejection. And so if the individual needs some practice with social skills, we will literally, especially for the teens I've worked with, we will practice making eye contact. We will practice asking questions. We will practice having conversations and not fidgeting with your hands or doing, I love the glass, the water drinking. I think a lot of people do this on first, like dead giveaway of a first date is when they're on like their eighth glass of water because they want to just, they're desperate to avoid that awkward pause, that awkward moment, like God forbid there was like a 2 second silence.
Yeah.
So any social skills training, we get practice tolerating silences, those awkward moments where you talk over one another and things like that. And you know, that's good for anyone, but I think if the person has a difficulty with some social skills, we want to make sure to address that's all part of the treatment.
Yeah, that sounds good, especially for someone with, let's say, Asperger's or autism. Yeah. Well, what percentage would you say through exposure therapy or some other form of therapy, has their social anxiety improved once they've engaged truthfully with some form of therapy?
So I'm a skeptic, and I think psychologists and psychological scientists get a lot of things wrong. I think we don't know as much as we think we do, and that's pretty scary. But what I'm confident of is that exposure therapy, when done correctly, treats anxiety. There will always be exceptions. There will always be a small subset of people who don't get better. But if exposure is done correctly by the therapist or the individual, and the person is motivated and willing to engage in the exposures, they will get better. And maybe that means their anxiety goes from a 10 to a 5. Maybe it means that they're engaging in 10% more social interactions than they did, but exposure works. There's neurobiological evidence, there's self-report evidence, there's observer rating evidence from observers. We know that exposure works for anxiety. But a key linchpin, in addition to what I talked about, is the person being willing to engage in exposure. And that's the hardest part. You are asking someone to do the thing that they fear most. And for someone with social anxiety, they might have had this fear for decades. Decades of their lives spent avoiding different social interactions and different parts of social interactions. And so it's not that you just show up one day and say, hey, I'm ready to do exposure, and you do it the next day. You really have to develop some good coping skills to be prepared for the exposure and be willing to confront the distress. And this is also why I think a lot of people don't seek out therapy, because the way to fix it is to do the thing that scares you. And so I think the people that do seek out therapy and or engage exposures on their own are the bravest among us. Those are the people that are willing to do the thing that scares them most.
Yeah, that is like the definition of bravery, right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. But that is great news to hear that for a lot of people, it seems like maybe even most people, it will get better. And you did put it in good context where maybe it's 10% more, but the 10% more, it enriches your life 10% more, right? Maybe even more than that, not to equate it one-to-one. And that's what it's all about, right? Like making, improving our mental health so that our lives can be a little bit easier, a little bit more fun, and we only have so much time. So might as well enjoy it.
Absolutely.
All right, you've got an event coming up, you know you got to send a card, so you get the card, it's looking good, you know, you chose a good one, you grab a pen, you grab a beverage of some kind, alcoholic, ginger ale. I've been big on the ginger ale lately. Even the diet. Am I just old? I'm just old. But you get all that, you sit down, and then, your mind is blank. You don't know what to say. It can be daunting. There's a lot of pressure. You gotta fit it in a certain area and gotta look nice. Go easy on yourself. There's someone here to help you. Introducing the Cardist Studio. With so many birthdays and occasions, there's no time to shop for cards, write the cards, and buy the stamps. It's too many steps. So many chances for anxiety. Now you can do it all right where you sit. That's the best. That's the best! Because the Cardist Studio does it for you. They write it down for you.
Introducing a writing specialist for the message inside your greeting cards. Don't get those canned responses. Have someone write something truly heartfelt. By the way, this is my friend Mary Alice who runs this company. She's very good. She sent me one of these. Whew. I know I said that in a joking tone, but I mean it. It was very thoughtful. She sent me one after my grandfather passed away. It means a lot. I still have the card. I mean, that shows you all you need to know. All right, here's how it works. All you do is pick the card and tell why you're sending it. No more errands. No more anxiety. For a message from your heart, but not your hands. It's okay. You still mean it. Sit back and just enjoy your relationships. Wouldn't that be nice? TheCardistStudio.com. Thoughtful, just got easy. And you can use the promo code ANXIETYPOD for 10% off all orders. All right, friends, get out there and send those greeting cards from the Cardist Studio.
Well, is there anything you'd like to mention or anything you think I'm missing here?
I think we've covered a lot of territory. I think yeah. Some key takeaways is that most people feel socially anxious at some point in their life, multiple points in their lives. A small subset of people, about 1 in 10 Americans, will have social anxiety disorder at some point in their lives. It's incredibly common. And I think maybe one thing we didn't mention is that it starts early. So about half of those who develop social anxiety disorder will have developed it before their 14th birthday.
Oh, wow.
That's really early. And it also, it's earlier than most mental illnesses, and it puts people at risk for developing other costly mental illnesses, like we talked about with substance use, but also things like depression, increased suicidality. And so there's a real, real need to identify young children and adolescents who are at risk before they spend years avoiding different social interactions and potentially developing other mental illnesses. And so, you know, whether that's through schools or parents or friends, the better we can get at identity. And this obviously earlier intervention and prevention is true for most illnesses, but it's so easy with social anxiety. Like, you can reliably detect social anxiety by asking like 3 questions. Now, is your fear of rejection among one of your worst fears? That's one of the best. Does your fear of rejection get in the way of living the life you want to live? Those sort of questions, they're not diagnostic, but they're screeners. And so if you can identify early enough, you can really prevent these awful trajectories. And the benefit of social anxiety is that if a child's in school and or extracurricular activities, they have these built-in opportunities for social exposure and relationship building. But they're only going to be helpful if you're addressing the root causes of the social anxiety. So I think one more thing I wanted to add is that the better we get at detecting social anxiety earlier enough, the better we can be about addressing it.
Hear, hear. I love that. Yeah, such a great conversation. How can people get a hold of you, or are you active on any social media or anything you'd like to mention?
My website is just my first and last name, FallonGoodman.com. I have Twitter. I think it's Fallon R. Goodman. I recently gave a TEDx talk and talked a lot about social anxiety, including some of the challenges with social media and the internet. Technology, how our social structures have really been upended and rewritten by technology. So if you're interested in some of that, you can check out that talk. And I'd love to hear from people.
That's great. Yeah. Congratulations on the TED Talk again. That's really awesome.
Thanks, Pat. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for your time.
I feel like my social anxiety is in a much better place than it was as we were starting to open up from the pandemic. I talked about it earlier in an earlier episode, but we went to a wedding in Brooklyn and just was like trembling in anxiety. Just being around people after not being around people, especially in a large group, it felt a bit suffocating. But the practice is getting there. And, this is certainly a few times I've felt that while performing at Theater 99, just being overwhelmed by looking at people. But then, the nice thing is the show starts, you can kind of dive into a character and you're looking more at your scene partner. So it sort of feels like it was like a training wheel situation towards getting back used to seeing people and talking to people. So yeah, thank you so much to Fallon Goodman. I want to remind everybody about my other podcast called Death Space Filling the Void. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts, or go to deathspacepodcast.com. There's also the Buy Me a Coffee link, which is in the description. It's a way to donate to the show if you're liking it and you want to help support it. Then there's the Instacart link. You can sign up through a link in the description of wherever you're listening. By signing up through that link, you're telling Instacart that this show sent you, which also helps support the show. I don't know why I'm struggling with my support the show. There's no H in support. There's also the My Software Tutor link with the promo code POD20, which gives you 20% off if you want to improve your Excel skills or learn about some other software. Go ahead and take advantage of that. And then there's the Cardis Studio with the promo code ANXIETYPOD, which gives you 10% off every order. I don't know about every order, but your order. Sorry, I've just got a lot of moving brain going on right now. Well, as always, thank you so much for listening. Have a great week, and I'll talk to you on Thursday.